And my kids, they don't help either. The other day I told my kid, I said, someday you'll have children of your own. He said, so will you. Real smart kid I got. The other day I told him about the birds and the bees. He told me about my wife and a butcher. I can't relax. My kid drives me nuts. The other day I told him, I says, you're young, you don't have it upstairs. He told me I'm old, I don't have it downstairs. I tell you, I can't take it no more. Well, this afternoon I said to my little girl, I says, when you grow up, what do you want to be? She looked at my wife. She said, single. Well, the other day I called my house. My boy answered the phone. I said to him, let me talk to mommy. I heard the kid say, mommy, it's daddy. Are you home? I don't get no respect from anyone. Well, last Christmas, my kid wanted a BB gun. I gave him a BB gun. He gave me a sweatshirt with a bullseye in the back. And my kids, they flip a coin to see who has to kiss me goodnight.
Good morning. It is Saturday, May the 13th, and this is The True Conservative. Welcome to all the butchers, bakers, and candlestick makers out there. I'm Ron, your host, and the only true conservative in the United States today. So today, after the Serenity Prayer and the Star Spangled Banner, we will have No Free Lunch, The Rape of the Mind, Benjamin Weicker, Societal Fissures, and Say No. All that and more when I get back. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing and remove your hats for the national anthem of the United States of America.
Thank you. And now, No Free Lunch, 250 Economic Truths by David Bonson.
Carefully as he spends his own. Nobody uses somebody else's resources as carefully as he uses his own. So if you want efficiency and effectiveness, if you want knowledge to be properly utilized, you have to do it through the means of private property. Milton Friedman. Here we see the undeniable utilitarian reality around private property. A concept rooted in the very notion of subsidiarity itself, carried out to its glorious logical conclusions. Optimal resource allocation comes from people caring for their own property. This has greater ramifications than just the way in which someone will be more careful with their own goods than a disinterested third party would. It speaks to the entire ecosystem of resource allocation. That each person holding, stewarding, nurturing, cultivating, considering, and perhaps liquidating their own assets, resources, and property will affect a wiser and more efficient process and result than any possible alternative.
So that was There's No Free Lunch by David Bonson. Back in a minute. Thank you. Who is the true conservative? He is the person that understands that conservatism is not just about politics, but culture as well. He is not selfish, but minds his own business. He acts like an adult. He is patriotic and uses common sense. He expresses what he knows and does so with absolute certainty. He makes judgments, refuses to speculate, speaks clearly and definitively, and is not afraid to say no. He's open-minded, asking why rather than why not. He is consistent, credible, and influential, not ashamed of his existence, unafraid to learn or correct his mistakes. He's a normal American, and he is better than the socialist. He's a better friend, father, brother, family member, and a better person, period. You have to know that. If you don't know with every fiber of your being that being a true conservative is best, then you're wasting your time. Back in a minute. Thank you. So I was just thinking about, for some reason, the Catholic Church and why the Catholic Church and just churches in general, Protestant churches as well, seem kind of marginalized in our society. And that's because the left has been very shrewd in going ahead and subverting other parts of our culture and having other parts of our culture work against the church. So, for instance, if the church has a says no promiscuity, you're not allowed to be out fornicating all the time, but you go to your doctor is going to be so-called neutral on the subject. It didn't used to be that way. It used to be that wherever you went in our society, whoever it is you were talking to reflected society's values. If society's values, which were based on church values, said thou shalt not be promiscuous, the doctor would tell you the same thing. If you're out saying, well, I'm going to go out and have sex, and he would wag his finger at you and say, you're 16 years old, you have no business going out and having sex. Or if you're an adult, your doctor would say, instead of going out and being promiscuous, what you should be doing is looking to get married and settle down and have a family. Okay, that's what they used to do. They don't do that anymore. Ostensibly, they've been neutralized, that the doctors claim that they're being neutral and that they're only concerned with their patient's health. But stop and think about it. Promiscuity leads to, one of the things it leads to is abortions. And one of the other things that it leads to is venereal disease. It's bad for your health. It's also bad for your health psychologically. It leads to depression, among other things. So the doctors are not being neutral at all. They're being pro-promiscuity is what they're doing. And this is, again, where I've said before that neutrality, other than in rare exceptions that I have documented or I've talked about on my podcast, doesn't exist. It doesn't exist when, I guess the best way to say it is, it doesn't exist when it comes to values. You either value one thing or you value the other. Either you value promiscuity or you value chastity. You value the family. Yeah, I guess that's the best way to put it. You value promiscuity or you value the family. And doctors should be telling their patients, for the sake of your health, you should quit being promiscuous. You should go find a wife, settle down, have kids, etc. So, but that's the reason that the churches seem marginalized. Yeah, the Catholic Church and the Protestant churches seem rather extremist. And the churches, I think, sense this, know this. They may not understand exactly why it is. I haven't for a long time. I just discovered this myself right now. And so that if we want to have the kind of society, the best kind of society possible, we have to have the parts of our society pulling together, working together, and not working against each other. Back in a minute. Thank you. So here again, more on a cultural note, there was looking at Instagram, and one of the people that I happened to be following, a female that was saying that, talking about She's an outdoorsman. She likes to go out in the outdoors, but she also likes to post pictures that are risque. Now, fine, you know. However, then she starts posting these something today that says a woman has the right to be sexual and not be hit on. A woman has the right to be sexual and blah, blah, blah. All these, you can, not this, not that, not the other thing. In other words, you have the right to post risque pictures, and I'm supposed to be, what, a eunuch? I'm supposed to be a marble statue or something? Or all men are supposed to be marble statues? If that was the case, we wouldn't follow you in the first place. We're not following you because we want to see pictures of the Grand Canyon. Okay, that's just the way it is. Plus, I have the right to say anything I want to say. If I want to go ahead and hit on somebody, I'm going to hit on them. Okay, now, I don't have the right to force myself on anybody, and I have no right to be rude about it. Okay, those are the conditions. So if she put that, a woman has the right to be sexual without having somebody be rude about it, okay, I can live with that. But when you start telling me you have the right to have this, your cake and eat it too, no, you damn well don't. Now, what it really sounds like is that this is a woman who doesn't want to say no, because that solves the whole problem, right? Guy hits on you, say no, thank you. That's it. You walk away. Or especially if it's on Instagram, he hits on you, you say no, thank you, but thanks for thinking about me, blah, 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 flirt with him or whatever. Which always gets me on Instagram. There was another woman that was doing the same thing. Instead of flirting with the guy and maybe getting having him go to her OnlyFans page or something and spend money, that she starts to whine and complain. You know, don't ask me this, don't ask me that. You know, that kind of thing. What are you doing? You're posting pictures of your risque pictures of yourself on Instagram, and now you're going to go ahead and make angry all the people that you want to follow you? I assume that you've got enough of a following that you're getting paid. So this is your job. Punch in and do your job. But anyways, go back to no. This is a woman that doesn't know how to say no. And it's simple. As I've said before, three ways to say no. You say no, then negotiate, or say yes with conditions. So there's all kinds of ways to handle it. I've seen women use these. One woman that I used to know in the Air Force, a guy was hitting on her, and he wanted her phone number. She said, why don't you give me your phone number? It's a way of saying yes with, or no, she's saying no and negotiating. No, I'm not going to give you my phone number, but you give me yours. What's the guy going to do? So he gives her his phone number. And he says, you're going to call me, right? And she says, yeah, absolutely. And of course, as soon as she leaves, she throws it in the trash. She does the guy thing, right? The guys that get their way with a woman and then here's my number. Oh, sure, I'll call you, honey. And then they never call, right? So she kind of reverse angle. But the point is, she said no and then negotiated. Okay? So, you know, in situations where it's awkward and she was at work, so she couldn't say no. She's not in an authority position. Now, if she's at home, she could say, no, I'm not interested. I'm sorry. Have a nice day. And make that stick. Anytime you're on your turf, whether it's your car, your home, your business, you have the right to say no. And I suggest you do it. Just say, no, not interested. They want an explanation. Sorry, just not interested. Have a nice day. Okay. And but any other place, if you're out in public, you're in a restaurant, you're at just out on the street somewhere, maybe at the doing some shopping, whatever, and you get the hit on, now it's a little bit different. And that's where you want to go to the other two. Either say no, then negotiate, or say yes with conditions. You know, another one is, no, I won't give you my phone number, but I'll give you my email address. There you go. Another one is, and I don't like this technique, though. I've heard of people that will, sure, here's my phone number, and they give them a phony phone number. Right? But the way around that is to have, he'll try and call you on the spot. So you can't do that one anymore anyways. But anyways, if you do that, that's lying. And I don't want to recommend lying to anybody. You shouldn't have to. Okay? That's like a desperation measure. If you get the idea that this guy's going to be getting violent if you say no, then, and you need a way out. Then perhaps. But anyways, three ways to say no. And obviously, because this is obviously a woman that doesn't know how to say no. And she thinks that men have the automatic obligation to shield her from the consequences of her actions. And we don't. As a matter of fact, it's immoral. Back in a minute. Thank you, thank you. And now, there's, let's see where we're at here, the rape of the mind.
Chapter 9, Fear as a Tool of Terror. The Fear of Living. In our era, the fear aroused by human relationships is so strong that inertia and mental death often seem more attractive than mental alertness and life. Classical psychology often spoke of the fear of death and the great unknown as the cause of many anxieties. But modern psychological studies have shown us that the fear of living is much greater, deeper, and more frightening one. Living often seems beyond our power. Stepping out of a relatively safe, childish dependence into freedom and responsibility is both hazardous and dangerous. Living demands activity and spontaneity, trial and error, sleeping and reawakening, competition and cooperation, adaptation and reorientation. Living involves manifold relationships, each of which has thousands of implications and complications. Living takes us away from the dream of being protected and demands that we expose our weaknesses and strength daily to our fellow men, with all their hostilities as well as their affections. It requires us to build up useful defenses and then to replace them with others because we have to change our goals in our relationships. It expects us to be lonely in order to cooperate in freedom. It asks us to submit and to conquer, to adjust and to rebel. It robs us of our childhood slumber of satisfaction and of the magic, omnipotent fantasies of our infancy. Living requires mutuality of giving and taking. Above all, to live is to love. And many people are afraid to take the responsibility of loving, of having an emotional investment in their fellow beings. They want only to be loved and to be protected. They are afraid of being hurt and rejected. We can see this clearly in the fact that so many people embrace so fervently all the limitations and frustrations of life that are offered to them. The neurotic limitations of the useful prejudices or the totalitarian limitations imposed by power politics. In his book, Escape from Freedom, Eric Fromm describes clearly how the pressures of freedom, when they are not balanced by responsibility and understanding, can drive men into the totalitarian frame of mind and into surrender of their hard-won liberties. Such surrender is nothing less than a slow mental death. Totalitarian leaders, whether of the right or of the left, know better than anyone else how to make use of this fear of living. They thrive on chaos and bewilderment. During unrest in international politics, they are most at ease. The strategy of fear is one of their most valuable tactics. The growing complications of our civilization and its administration make the impact of power politics felt more than ever. When the totalitarians add to their tactics all the clever tricks that we have already discussed, Pavlovian conditioning, repeated suggestion, deconditioning through boredom and physical degradation, they can win their battle for the control of man's mind. In the earlier chapters of this book, we described in some detail the techniques by which man could be turned into a robot in the service of totalitarianism and some of the tendencies that operate, even in the free countries, to rob man of his mental integrity. It is important for us to realize that emphasis on conformity and the fear of spontaneous living can have an effect almost as devastating as the totalitarians' deliberate assault on the mind. Conformity and the fear of living rob the free way of life of its greatest asset in the struggle against totalitarianism. Our human strength lies in our diversity and independence of thought, in our acceptance of nonconformity, in our willingness to discuss and to eliminate various conflicting points of view. In denying these diversities of life and the complexity and individuality of the human mind, in preaching rigid dogmas and self-righteousness, we begin gradually to adopt the totalitarian attitude we deplore. Delusion has never been the exclusive property of any one country, class, or group, and the totalitarian delusion, which in itself promotes menticide, can invade us from many fronts, from the right as well as the left, from the rich or from the underprivileged, from the conservatives and from the rebels. Fear and intimidation have not only been the result, but also the tools of mental coercion. Although there is as yet no unified theory of fear and anxiety, and we therefore do not know precisely why and how the development of these feelings leads to such dire consequences, it is important for us to understand what useful tools fear and panic are, and to see, through description, what these overwhelming emotions are able to do to people. Most people think of fear reactions as hysterical expressions of desperation. But as this chapter should make clear, fear and panic also have their paradoxical expressions in indifference and apathy, reactions which, just because they are less commonly recognized as fear-created, can be more dangerous to the individual than a good hysterical cry. It is the hidden, silent fears that have such an impact on our social and political behavior. Fear and panic are reactions not only to overt danger and threat, they are also reactions to the slow, seeping intrusion of disquieting propaganda and the constant wave of suggestion to which we are all exposed. Fear is at work all around us, and often it shows its shadows where we least expect to find them. We may be acting out of fear without even knowing it. We may consider that our behavior is perfectly normal and rational when, in fact, psychology tells us that creeping fear may already have begun to work on us. Fear and catastrophe fortify the need to identify with the strong leader. They lead to herding together of people who shy away from wanting to be individual cells any longer. They prefer to be a part of a huge, mystic social organization that protects against threat and distress, in oneness with the leader. This protection-seeking instinctual reaction is also directed against dissent and individualism, against the individual ego. We see in this a regression toward a more primitive state of mass participation. True, this process of ego shrinking is the negative side of the back-to-the-masses reaction, yet it stimulates a recognition of greater need for cooperation and mutual help. During the last war and the generally experienced emergencies, many people became, for the first time, aware of the effective ties they had with their neighbors. At the same time, anxiety can inspire suspicion and the need for seeking scapegoats. It is the paradox of fear that it propagates warm feelings of immature ties and cold suspicion at the same time. Although there is throughout the world a conscious trend toward overcoming fear and feelings of insecurity, there is also a less conscious countercurrent provoking new fears and anxieties and insecurities. Whether he is aware of it or not, modern man lives in an atmosphere of fear. Fear of war, fear of the H-bomb, fear of totalitarianism, fear of nonconformism, fear of dissent. Fear has already begun to influence our behavior by the time we are aware of it. Once fear has penetrated the mind and stimulated fantasy, it begins to direct our actions, whether we want it to or not. We cannot eliminate all the thousands of stresses and fear-provoking situations in the modern world, but we can learn to recognize and understand some of the most common forms of fear reactions. In this way, we can find a partial release from the tensions they create and can learn how to cope with them more effectively.
And that was Chapter 9, Fear as a Tool of Terror from The Rape of the Mind. Now, I did have a couple of comments to make here. He's very Freudian in the way he analyzes things, and he's also very wrong. He says in this particular case that everybody is scared, and it's this Freudian thing, a separation anxiety from our parents, which is absolute crap. When we leave the womb, from the time we leave the womb until the time we are able to leave the house when we're 18 years old, we're seeking independence. We're on the process of becoming more and more and more independent. Whether or not we are going to be healthy and happy adults rather than cringing and fearful adults depends on the adults we're surrounded with when we grow up. If those adults teach us and teach us how to deal with things, not just teach us mathematics and English and whatnot, but do things like teaching us how to do a budget, how to go and apply for a job, et cetera, how to manage our time. Then we're going to be healthy and happy adults. And if we have we're surrounded by adults that are not capable or willing to do those things, then yes, those adults, those people are going to be much more fearful than they should be. So that was, again, The Rape of the Mind from Juice Mirlo, M.D. Back in a minute. Thank you. Yesterday, I played Speechless from Michael Knowles, Chapter 7. And he was talking about feminism and basically gave a history of feminism, and that was about it. I'm expecting from that book that he's going to provide a critique, because that's what Michael Knowles generally does. He makes commentary. He's not a historian. He's not a news guy. So I found his presentation on feminism very bland, very neutral. And so now what I'm going to do is contrast that with Benjamin Weicker, PhD. He wrote a book that's called 10 Books That Screwed Up the World and 5 Others That Didn't Help. And this is chapter 15, and it's all about feminism.
Part 3, Dishonorable Mention. Chapter 15, The Feminine Mystique, 1963. As she made the beds, shopped for groceries, matched slipcover material, ate peanut butter sandwiches with her children, chauffeured Cub Scouts and brownies, lay beside her husband at night, she was afraid to ask, even of herself, the silent question, is this all? Betty Friedan, 1921 to 2006. I end with the consideration of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, not because we need a token female. We already have Margaret Sanger and Margaret Mead. Bad books are an equal opportunity employer, but because we need a token of feminism, a movement that left its own distinct historical mark, even while it shared in many of the assumptions we've already seen. Betty Friedan is credited with launching the second wave of feminism, though some of the original feminists, like Susan B. Anthony, had they lived to see her, might have repudiated her. As with Mead and Kinsey, Friedan's private life makes for an illuminating gloss upon her writings, especially her most famous, The Feminine Mystique. Once again, we see autobiography masquerading as science, and we can see how much the second wave of feminism was defined by Friedan's personality and personal conflicts. She was born in Peoria, Illinois, Betya, not Betty originally, Naomi Goldstein, the daughter of Harry Goldstein, a jeweler, and his domineering and bitter but beautiful young wife, Miriam Horwitz Goldstein. Both parents were Jewish immigrants, and the upper-middle-class Goldstein family suffered its share of callous snubbing. From her father, Betya inherited her atheism. From her mother, she inherited a violent temper. Her mother's stunning beauty went entirely to Betya's sister, Amy. As even her most sympathetic biographers note, Betya was quite homely, which her mother never let her forget, and this consciousness of her unattractiveness, coupled with her aching desire for romance, seared her soul deeply from early childhood. But just as scarring was her hot-tempered mother, all sweetness to those outside, and a witch to her own family, she looked down on her husband, considering herself too high society for him, and Betya's prominent nose, bequeathed by her father, increased her hostility toward Betya. The Goldstein house was filled with rancor as Miriam spent far beyond Harry's means to properly adorn her elevated self-image, even when the Great Depression hit the jeweler's business hard and continually berated Betya. To add a particularly important bitterness to an already harsh marital stew, Harry had insisted Miriam quit her job writing for the society pages and devote herself to being a housewife. By her own admission, Betya would associate her mother's constant rage and the consequent deep unhappiness of the Goldstein home with her mother's bitterness at having to give up socialite journalism. Finding a cure for this childhood misery is the hidden autobiographical substrate of The Feminine Mystique. The Feminine Mystique is a very long book, much longer than it needs to be for its quite simple message. Women who are only wives and mothers are secretly or openly miserable because they cannot venture outside the home and cheerfully maximize their potential as human beings in meaningful work, just as men do. Boiled down to the bones, the flaws of the feminine mystique become apparent. Friedan seems to assume that men working outside the home are happily fulfilling their deepest human longings in meaningful work as journalists, college professors, advertising executives, airplane pilots, and doctors, rather than engaging in the actual drudgery, the real bone-grinding and mind-numbing toil which fills the days of almost all actual working men, and which finds them wearily sapped of strength at the end of the day. It assumes a kind of glamour, mystique, we might dare call it, to working outside the home, that real experience in the actual work that most men do in ditches, factories, welding shops, and even banks and accounting firms would cure. This abstractness from actual conditions mars much of Ferdinand's analysis. Before she published The Feminine Mystique, Ferdinand had spent years in Marxist-inspired agitation on behalf of mistreated lower-class workers, and the abstractness of her analysis is fundamentally Marxist. But we are getting ahead of ourselves. At this juncture, we need to make one fairly simple assertion about Ferdinand. Ferdinand romanticized working outside the home and demonized the role of housewife. She did so on the basis not only of her mother's volcanic discontent at staying home, but also of her own. She assumed, as cold fact, that all women suffered the same restless dissatisfaction as her mother and herself. Such is clear from the opening chapters of The Feminine Mystique, in which Ferdinand attempts to demonstrate that, despite their seeming contentment and the unsettling trend, unsettling to Ferdinand at least, of women marrying enthusiastically and early, housewives were sorely afflicted with the problem that has no name. The problem lay buried, unspoken for many years in the minds of American women. It was a strange stirring, a sense of dissatisfaction, a yearning that women suffered in the middle of the 20th century in the United States. Each suburban wife struggled with it alone. As she made the beds, shopped for groceries, matched slipcover material, ate peanut butter sandwiches with her children, chauffeured Cub Scouts and brownies, lay beside her husband at night, she was afraid to ask even of herself the silent question, is this all? These heart-rent housewives, claimed Ferdinand, had been sold a bill of goods designed to keep them in shackles. The feminine mystique, the notion that they could desire no greater destiny than to glory in their own femininity and claim occupation housewife as the sum of their status. But according to Ferdinand, the happy facade was rapidly peeling away. As women's magazines and the latest psychological research demonstrated, the suburban housewife was a cauldron of neurotic discontent boiling over the national landscape despite the efforts of men, especially those lording over big business, to keep the lid on. Rather than the cheerful housewife of advertising fiction, Ferdinand pulled the curtain to reveal the purposelessness, uncreative, even sexually joyless lives of the suburban housewives who, because of the feminine mystique, trap themselves in that one passion, one occupation, one role in life. According to Ferdinand, they were doomed to suffer ultimately that bored, diffuse feeling of purposelessness, non-existence, non-involvement with the world that can be called anomie, and hence live desperate lives of emptiness, idleness, boredom, alcoholism, drug addiction, disintegration to fat, disease, and despair after 40 when their sexual function has been filled. The blissful housewife, Ferdinand assures the reader, is merely a myth of the mystique, and she ought to know, for she was unable to find even one. With a vision of the happy modern housewife, as she is described by the magazines and television, by sociologists, educators, and the manipulators dancing before my eyes, I went in search of one of those mystical creatures. Like Diogenes looking for a wise man with his lamp, I went as a reporter from suburb to suburb, searching for a woman of ability and education who was fulfilled as a housewife. Alas, all to no avail. She went to one upper-income development, where she interviewed 28 housewives who appeared to exemplify the mystique of feminine fulfillment. But what was Mummy really like? 16 out of the 28 were in analysis of analytical psychotherapy. 18 were taking tranquilizers. Several had tried suicide. And some had been hospitalized for varying periods for depression or vaguely diagnosed psychotic states. You'd be surprised at the number of these happy suburban wives who simply go berserk one night and run shrieking through the street without any clothes on, said the local doctor, not a psychiatrist, who had been called in such emergencies. 12 were engaged in extramarital affairs, in fact or in fancy. And on it goes, page after morbid page, until the reader is depressed into submission to the baleful, cold reality of the housewife's trap. The problem that has no name, announces Ferdinand gravely, putting the final flourishes on the feminine mystique, which is simply the fact that American women are kept from growing to their full human capacities, is taking a far greater toll on the physical and mental health of our country than any known disease. So it was that, through the ministrations of the feminine mystique, housewifery became the cancer or AIDS of the 1960s. But how strong is her argument? For Dan's case that all or even most suburban housewives lead lives of unnamed desperation is shoddy. It is reasonable to suppose that some housewives, other than for Dan, fit her morose description, whether or not the cause was as she described. But some is quite different from all or most. As some doesn't make for a revolution, Ferdan had to manipulate the reader's impressions accordingly. As a consequence, there is a lot of, I became aware of a growing body of evidence, much of which has not been reported publicly because it does not fit current modes of thought about women, which is a good sign that the author was trying to grow much of the evidence herself. There is a great deal of anecdotal evidence that would be difficult, if not impossible, to verify. I sat in the office of another old-timer, one of the few women editors left in the women's magazine world. A therapist at another college told me of girls who, when I was interviewing on college campuses in the late 50s, chaplains and sociologists alike testified. Later, when I saw this same pattern repeated over and over again in similar suburbs, I knew it could hardly be a coincidence. While I never found a woman who actually fitted that happy housewife image. Or worse, the anecdotal evidence becomes pre-upholstered with her conclusions. Recently, interviewing high school girls who had started out full of promise and talent, but suddenly stopped their education, I began to see new dimensions to the problem of feminine conformity. Or perhaps most offensive of all, the cobbling of anecdote into pseudo-law. I noticed this pattern again and again as I interviewed women. Is transformed into, for example, the more a woman is deprived of function in society at the level of her own ability, the more her housework, mother work, wife work will expand, and the more she will resist finishing her housework or mother work. While anecdotal impressions have their place, one thinks of Tocqueville's masterful analysis in Democracy in America, they can all too easily be used as substitutes for deeper analysis that might well contradict the surface sketch. Sometimes the anecdotal is coupled with runaway rhetoric that takes the place of proof, such as her claim that a McCall's article titled The Mother Who Ran Away brought the highest readership of any article they had ever run, resulting in the response of a former editor that, we suddenly realized that all those women at home with their 3.5 children were miserably unhappy. This article was published in 1956. McCall's had been published, starting under a different name, for more than 75 years. Could the article really have had the highest readership ever? Measured by what? How? Even if there was a heady response to the article, and all the responses were positive, would that have meant that all those women at home with their 3.5 children were miserably unhappy? Other times, cumulative evidence is strung together into bizarre conclusions, the strangeness of which was apparently lost on Ferdan. She cites a study of Green, Massachusetts, where loveless parents, mostly Polish immigrants, routinely brutalized their rebellious children. Ferdan reports that the regularly beaten and neglected children suffered no psychological damage because their mothers, like their fathers, worked all day in the factories. According to Ferdan, the researcher conducting the study wondered whether the very absence of this omnipresent nurturing mother love might explain why these children did not suffer the neurotic symptoms so commonly found in the sons of middle-class parents. So, it's much better to be unloved, neglected, and beaten than smothered by motherly love? It would seem so, even when the data indicates otherwise. Though she concedes that many studies purport to show the detrimental effects on children whose mothers work, Ferdan reads them differently, saying they actually indicate that, where other conditions are equal, the children of mothers who work because they want to are less likely to be disturbed, have problems in school, or to lack a sense of personal worth than housewives' children. Further, she writes that there is no definitive evidence that children are less happy, healthy, adjusted because their mothers work, though she cites only one article as proof. And indeed, the horrors of maternal overprotection, she claims, are well documented in a famous study of 20 mothers who had damaged their children to a pathological extent by material infantilization, indulgence, and overprotection. Small wonder, then, that there was increasing national awareness by the mid-20th century that something was wrong with American mothers. Is not the real implication of this swell of data that the role of the middle-class American housewife forces many a mother to smother, absorb the personality of both her sons and daughters? Luckily, there is a model for proper child-rearing, and it can be found behind the Iron Curtain. Not long ago, Dr. Spock confessed, a bit uneasily, that Russian children, whose mothers usually have some purpose in their lives besides motherhood, they work in medicine, science, education, industry, government, art, seemed somehow more stable, adjusted, mature than American children, whose full-time mothers do nothing but worry about them. Could it be that Russian women are somehow better mothers because they have a serious purpose in their own lives? This hint of Marxism is telling. Despite her attempts to hide her radical past, Ferdan was not an innocent suburban housewife who suddenly realized she was unrealized. She had been a Marxist since her college days at Smith in the late 1930s and early 1940s. In the years after, she belonged to, worked for, or wrote positively about a string of leftist organizations and publications, like the Popular Front, the Federated Press, UE News, Congress of American Women, Jewish Life, that had significant communist membership or Soviet sympathies. Knowing that the call to revolution in the feminine mystique would be damaged if it was associated with the call to revolution in the Communist Manifesto, she hid her radical past. When Ferdan biographer Daniel Horowitz brought it up to her, the previously cooperative Ferdan immediately closed the lid on her private papers. But isn't this just red-baiting, discrediting her later mature work on the basis of a youthful indiscretion? I think not. Ferdan interpreted the fact that women were housewives in terms of a great Marxian historical dialectic. In a chapter of The Feminine Mystique, devoted to critiquing fellow traveler Margaret Mead, The Functional Freeze, The Feminine Protest, and Margaret Mead, she argued that Mead failed to see that technology was overcoming nature and hence making obsolete sexual differences based upon nature. In Samoa, where the modes of production are primitive, and because of hot weather and scant clothing, the modes of reproduction are evident, then defining a woman as wife and mother makes sense because having a baby is the pinnacle of achievement. But Mead's Samoans lacked the complex goals of more advanced civilizations, in which instinct and environment are increasingly controlled and transformed by the human mind. In romanticizing the Samoans, a tendency Ferdan ultimately blames on Mead's reliance on Freud, Mead was helping entrap American women in the feminine mystique. Margaret Mead's eloquent pages made a great many American women envy the serene femininity of a bare-breasted Samoan and try to make themselves into languorous savages, breasts unfettered by civilization's brassieres and brains undisturbed by pallid man-made knowledge of the goals of human progress. Mead offered a vision of the mystique where women, by merely being women and bearing children, will earn the same respect accorded men for their creative achievements. The ill effect of this vision is that femininity becomes more than its definition by society. It becomes a value which society must protect from the destructive onrush of civilization, like the vanishing buffalo. That makes Mead a dangerous reactionary whose words acquire the aura of a righteous crusade, a crusade against change. Against the romance of primitivism, which grounds the feminine mystique in nature, progress means conquering the natural conditions that keep women from being defined by their sex. As with Marxism, the creative, destructive onrush of technical progress will ultimately free human nature from the shackles of nature and obsolete culture. We can now see her focus on the upper-middle-class suburban housewife in a new light. The suburban housewife was at the edge of the final stage of the great historical dialectic. She, not her husband, was the first creature freed by labor-saving devices in the final overcoming of material conditions that defined human beings by their labor. The problem was that she was spending her leisure in housebound boredom rather than in creative and socially constructive work outside the home. But not Betty Friedan. Despite her attempt to portray herself as just one more innocent housewife trapped by the false consciousness of suburbia, Fredan was continually active in agitation, and, save for a few months, was always focused on building her writing career, using her and her husband Carl's earnings to pay for the child care and maid service that freed her to do creative and meaningful work. Here again, we see how much Fredan resembled her own mother. A fundamental distaste for domesticity and a passionate desire to make good as a writer. The difference was that in Fredan's case, she was not going to let her husband stand in the way. The result was a sad duplication of the bitterness of her childhood household, except that both Betty and Carl were given to dishing out physical as well as verbal abuse. The bitterness was mollified by the feeling that she was in the advance guard of the revolution, the first to be released from the false consciousness of the feminine mystique. Privileged enough to be educated by radical college professors at the elite Smith College and to live in an 11-room house with 3 bathrooms and marble fireplaces in Rockland County, New York, while writing The Feminine Mystique, she had the intellectual preparation and leisure to act as the vanguard who would awaken other upper-middle-class white women. Awaken them to do what? If we might crib from Marx and Engels's German ideology, after the revolution, in Fredan's hoped-for society, government will provide daycare for children and subsidize women's continuing education. Women could then hunt for bargains in the morning, fish for writing jobs in the afternoon, rear children in the evening, criticize art and literature after dinner, and never become solely a bargain hunter, a writer for hire, a mother, or a critic. As others have noticed, Fredan's book was aimed at a revolution of a very small, elite group of upper-middle-class, intellectually inclined women who could be doctors, lawyers, writers, artists, physicists, architects, or actresses, the sort of people she lived with in Rockland County. She seemed unconcerned in her own life and in the Mystique's new life plan for women with the emancipation of the women who cleaned the houses of the revolutionaries or took care of their children. Well, then, what evils can we chalk up to Betty Friedan's feminine mystique? First, Friedan sowed discontent by demonizing the role of housewives and romanticizing working outside the home. As even her sympathetic biographer Daniel Horowitz notes, Friedan presented a distorted view of the real situation and feelings of suburban housewives in the 1950s, reporting anything that was negative and suppressing anything that was positive, needing the data to fit her need for a crisis and ignoring, as Marx did, anything that contradicted her grand abstract thesis. Second, Fredan dragged Marx and Engels off the shoproom floor and snuck them into the home. Examine this summary statement by Fredan of women's need to break free of the housewife trap. To emancipate woman and make her the equal of the man is and remains an impossibility, so long as the woman is shut out from socially productive labor and restricted to private domestic labor. The emancipation of woman will only be possible when woman can take part in production on a large social scale and domestic work no longer claims anything but an insignificant amount of her time. There are a number of statements like this throughout the Mystique. They reflect Fredan's passionate concern that suburban women not use their freedom merely to become community volunteers, but to get out into the professional workforce, where meaningful work really takes place. The only difficulty is that this quote actually comes from Chapter 9 of Friedrich Engels' essay, The Origin of the Family, Private Property, and the State. Fredan had copied it down during her research for The Mystique, and it entered into the stream of her own thinking. So no one can doubt that Engels expressed Fredan's thesis, or rather, that Fredan elaborated Engels' thesis. Third, and most dishonorable of all, Fredan initially hid not only the radical roots, but also the radical implications of her argument, although she fully intended their results. Nowhere, for instance, in The Feminine Mystique of 1963 do we find the word abortion. Yet in later editions, we find in her added epilogue, written in 1973, the same year as Roe v. Wade, a happy celebration of the necessity of abortion for her revolution. Society had to be restructured so that women, who happen to be the people who give birth, could make a human, responsible choice whether or not, and when, to have children, and not be barred thereby from participating in society in their own right. This meant the right to birth control and safe abortion, the right to maternity leave and child care centers if women did not want to retreat completely from adult society during the childbearing years, and the equivalent of a GI Bill for retraining if women chose to stay home with the children. For it seemed to me that most women would still choose to have children, though not so many, if child-rearing was no longer their only road to status and economic support, a vicarious participation in life. With Bernard Nathanson, Ferdan started NARAL in 1969. The acronym then stood for the National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws. Roe v. Wade was their big victory. The right of a woman to kill her unborn child was necessary for her emancipation from being defined as a mother. As with Marx, the passionate abstractness of the revolution leaves little time for concern over concrete and massive carnage. On rough calculation, the number of abortions in America since Roe v. Wade has been around 48 million, surpassing the number slaughtered by Lenin and Stalin in the name of communism. But that is not all. To ensure that occupation housewife would become a distant memory, Ferdan was a co-founder of NOW, the National Organization for Women. For Ferdan, NOW was her dream agitating organization, allowing her the kind of prestige and acclaim she had long desired and the political clout necessary to effect the societal changes necessary so that women would not be, in Engels' words, shut out from socially productive labor and restricted to private domestic labor. It is fair to say, as a kind of postscript, that Ferdan long resisted the more radical elements of NOW, although not those of NARAL. She was not a man-hater, her phrase, nor was she sympathetic to lesbianism. On a charitable reading of her life and the feminine mystique, Ferdan wanted both a happy home and, at the same time, freedom from its constraints to pursue what she considered to be more valuable and meaningful activities. Perhaps this is her most dangerous legacy. She helped spawn the notion that a combination of a very part-time motherhood and full-time professional life was an achievable and desirable goal. Against almost all psychological research, she argued that children would feel loved if mothers gave them a kiss in the morning and a kiss at night and left them to schools, daycares, and televisions in between. Even on the left, there is a simmering rebellion against Ferdan's vision because it is recognized as a lie. Michelle Obama, wife of Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama, confessed at a fundraiser, "I don't know about you, but as a mother, wife, professional with a $300,000 income, campaign wife, whatever it is that's on my plate, I'm drowning. And nobody's talking about these issues. In my adult lifetime, I felt duped." She continued, "People told me, you can do it all. Just stay the course, get your education, and you can raise a child, stay thin, be in shape, love your man, look good, and raise healthy children. That was a lie." But then the only answer she can give is Ferdan's. "America," Obama says, "needs universal health care, access to child care, and better schools." And she herself is looking for someone, not just a woman, but someone who understands my struggles. So goes the revolution.
And that was chapter 15 from 10 Books That Screwed Up the World by Benjamin Weicker. And you'll notice the difference between what he was doing or saying about Betty Friedan and what was being said by Michael Knowles about the feminist movement. So to kind of synopsize, he calls it an autobiography masked as a scientific work that is far too long for the message that it's giving, that basically women are unhappy, and so that needs to be fixed. Our society needs to be reformed to make women happy. He breaks down Ferdan's style, saying that she has a lack of evidence that she and she pulls. There's a lot of tricks that we put up with today that he discussed in terms of critiquing her book. What else we got? Demonization. Her book was full of, it was Marxist, full of demonization, distortion. It was meant to promote Marx and Engels. hidden radicalism, a promotion for abortion, and a way of trying to convince women that they could have their cake and eat it too. So they could be full-time mothers, full-time outside the home, and everything's going to be fine. And it was Mrs. Obama that went ahead and refuted all that by saying that she was lied to, that she was promised that she could have it all, she could be a mother and a working lady, et cetera, and it's BS. And that's right. You can't have your cake and eat it too. That's a metaphysical rule. It's not a man's rule. It's not a conservative's rule. It is the rule of God. Back in a minute. This is Ron, your host, the only true conservative in the United States today, bidding adios to all the butchers, bakers, and candlestick makers out there. So I'm reminding you that the left has no authority, no power, and they can't win.